Is there some psychic kink that exists on a deeper level of my mind? Art used the vertical arrow technique to answer these questions. First, he drew a short downward arrow directly beneath his automatic thought. See Figure 10-2 in the enhancement. This downward arrow is a form of shorthand which tells Art to ask himself, if this automatic thought were actually true, what would it mean to me? Why would it be upsetting to me? Then Art wrote down the next automatic thought that immediately came to mind. As you can see, he wrote, if Dr. B thinks I'm a lousy therapist, it would mean I was a lousy therapist because Dr. B is an expert. Next, Art drew a second downward arrow beneath this thought and repeated the same process so as to generate yet another automatic thought, as shown in Figure 10-2 on the enhancement. Every time he came up with a new automatic thought, he immediately drew a vertical arrow beneath it and asked himself, if that were true, why would it upset me? As he did this over and over, he was able to generate a chain of automatic thoughts, which led to the silent assumptions that gave rise to his problems. The downward arrow method is analogous to peeling successive layers of skin off an onion to expose the ones beneath. It is actually quite simple and straightforward, as you will see in Figure 10-2 on the enhancement. You will notice that the vertical arrow technique is the opposite of the usual strategy you use when recording your automatic thoughts. Ordinarily, you substitute a rational response that shows why your automatic thought is distorted and invalid, Figure 10-1. This helps you change your thinking patterns in the here and now so that you can think about life more objectively and feel better. In the vertical arrow method, you imagine instead that your distorted automatic thought is absolutely valid, and you look for the grain of truth in it. This enables you to penetrate the core of your problems. Now review Art's chain of automatic thoughts in Figure 10-2 on the enhancement and ask yourself, what are the silent assumptions that predispose him to anxiety, guilt, and depression? There are several. 1. If someone criticizes me, they're bound to be correct. 2. My worth is determined by my achievement. 3. One mistake and the whole is ruined. If I'm not successful at all times, I'm a total zero. 4. Others won't tolerate my imperfection. I have to be perfect to get people to respect and like me. When I goof up, I'll encounter fierce disapproval and be punished. 5. This disapproval will mean I am a bad, worthless person. Once you have generated your own chain of automatic thoughts and clarified your silent assumptions, it is crucial to pinpoint the distortions and substitute rational responses, as you usually do. For further illustration, please see Figure 10-3 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. The beauty of the downward arrow method is that it is inductive and Socratic. Through a process of thoughtful questioning, you discover on your own the beliefs that defeat you. You unearth the origin of your problems by repeating the following questions over and over. If that negative thought were true, what would it mean to me? Why would it upset me? Without introducing some therapist's subjective bias or personal beliefs or theoretical leanings, you can objectively and systematically go right to the root of your problems. This circumvents a difficulty that has plagued the history of psychiatry. Therapists from all schools of thought have been notorious for interpreting patients' experiences in terms of preconceived notions that may have little or no experimental validation. If you don't buy your therapist's explanation of the origin of your problems, this is likely to be interpreted as resistance to the truth. In this subtle way, your troubles get forced into your therapist's mold regardless of what you say. Imagine the bewildering array of explanations for suffering that you would hear if you went to a religious counselor, spiritual factors, a psychiatrist in a communist country, the social, political, economic environment, a Freudian analyst, internalized anger, a behavior therapist, a low rate of positive reinforcement, a drug-oriented psychiatrist, genetic factors and brain chemistry imbalance, a family therapist, disturbed interpersonal relationships, etc. A word of caution when you apply the vertical arrow method. You will short-circuit the process if you write down thoughts that contain descriptions of your emotional reactions. Instead, write down the negative thoughts that cause your emotional reactions. Here's an example of the wrong way to do it. First automatic thought. My boyfriend didn't call me this weekend as he promised he would. Why is that upsetting to me? What does it mean to me? Second automatic thought. Oh, it's awful and terrible because I can't stand it. This is useless. We already know you feel awful and terrible. The question is, what thoughts automatically crossed your mind that caused you to feel so upset? What would it mean to you if he had neglected you? Here's the correct way to do it. 1. My boyfriend didn't call me this weekend as he promised he would. Why would that be upsetting to me? What does it mean to me? 2. That means he's neglecting me. That means he really doesn't love me. And suppose that were true. What would that mean to me? 3. That would mean there's something wrong with me. Otherwise, he'd be more attentive. And suppose that were true. What would that mean to me? 4. That would mean I was going to be rejected. And if I were in fact rejected, what then? What would that mean to me? 5. That would mean I was unlovable and I would always be rejected. And if that happened, why would it upset me? 6. That would mean I'd end up alone and miserable. Thus, by pursuing the meaning rather than your feelings, your silent assumptions became obvious. 1. If I'm not loved, I'm not worthwhile. And 2. I'm bound to be miserable if I'm alone. This is not to say your feelings aren't important. The whole point is to deliver the real McCoy, valid emotional transformation. The Dysfunctional Attitude Scale, DAS. Because of the crucial importance of eliciting the silent assumptions that give rise to your mood swings, a second, simpler method for eliciting them called the Dysfunctional Attitude Scale, DAS, has been developed by a member of our group, Dr. Arlene Weissman. She has compiled a list of 100 self-defeating attitudes that commonly occur in individuals predisposed to emotional disorders. Her research has indicated that while negative automatic thoughts are reduced dramatically between episodes of depression, a self-defeating belief system remains more or less constant during episodes of depression and remission. Dr. Weissman's studies confirm the concept that your silent assumptions represent a predisposition to emotional turbulence that you carry with you at all times. Although a complete presentation of the lengthy dysfunctional attitude scale would be beyond the scope of this audiobook, I have selected a number of the more common attitudes and have added several others which will be useful. As you fill out the questionnaire found on the enhancement, indicate how much you agree or disagree with each attitude. When you are finished, an answer key will let you score your answers and generate a profile of your personal value systems. This will show your areas of psychological strength and vulnerability. Answering the test is quite simple. After each of the 35 attitudes, put a check in the column that represents your estimate of how you think most of the time. Be sure to choose only one answer for each attitude. Because we are all different, there is no right or wrong answer to any statement. To decide whether a given attitude is typical of your own philosophy, recall how you look at things most of the time. Interpreting your DAS scores. 1. Approval. The first 5 attitudes on the DAS test probe your tendency to measure your self-esteem based on how people react to you and what they think of you. A positive score between 0 and 10 indicates you're independent, with a healthy sense of your own worth even when confronted with criticism and disapproval. A negative score between 0 and minus 10 indicates you're excessively dependent because you evaluate yourself through other people's eyes. If someone insults you or puts you down, you automatically tend to look down on yourself. Since your emotional well-being is exquisitely sensitive to what you imagine people think of you, you can be easily manipulated, and you are vulnerable to anxiety and depression when others criticize you or are angry with you. 2. Love. The second 5 attitudes on the test assess your tendency to base your worth on whether or not you are loved. A positive score indicates you see love as desirable, but you have a wide range of other interests you also find gratifying and fulfilling. Hence, love is not a requirement for your happiness or self-esteem. People are likely to find you attractive because you radiate a healthy sense of self-love and are interested in many aspects of living. A negative score indicates you are a love junkie. You see love as a need without which you cannot survive, much less be happy. The closer your score is to minus 10, the more dependent on love you are. You tend to adopt inferior, put-down roles in relationships with people you care about for fear of alienating them. The result of this, more often than not, is that they lose respect for you and consider you a burden because of your attitude that without their love you would collapse. As you sense that people drift away from you, You become gripped by a painful, terrifying withdrawal syndrome. You realize you may not be able to shoot up with your daily dose of affection and attention. You then become consumed by the driving compulsion to get love. Like most junkies, you may even resort to coercive, manipulative behavior to get your stuff. Ironically, your needy, greedy love addiction drives many people away, thus intensifying your loneliness. 3. Achievement. Your score on attitudes 11 through 15 will help you measure a different type of addiction. A negative score indicates you are a workaholic. You have a constricted sense of your own humanity, and you see yourself as a commodity in the marketplace. The more negative your score, the more your sense of self-worth and your capacity for joy are dependent on your productivity. If you go on vacation, if your business slumps, if you retire or become ill and inactive, you will be in danger of an emotional crash. Economic and emotional depressions will seem identical to you. A positive score, in contrast, indicates that you enjoy creativity and productivity, but do not see them as an exclusive or necessary road to self-esteem and satisfaction. 4. Perfectionism. Items 16 through 20 measure your tendency to perfectionism. A negative score indicates you are hooked on searching for the Holy Grail. You demand perfection in yourself. Mistakes are taboo, failure is worse than death, and even negative emotions are a disaster. You're supposed to look, feel, think, and behave superbly at all times. You sense that being less than spectacular means burning in the flames of hell. Although you drive yourself at an intense pace, your satisfactions are meager. Once you do achieve a goal, another more distant goal instantly replaces it, so you never experience the reward of getting to the top of the mountain. Eventually, you begin to wonder why the promised payoff from all your effort never seems to materialize. Your life becomes a joyless, tedious treadmill. You are living with unrealistic, impossible personal standards, and you need to reevaluate them. Your problem does not lie in your performance, but in the yardstick you use to measure it. If you bring your expectations in line with reality, you will be regularly pleased and rewarded instead of frustrated. A positive score suggests you have the capacity to set meaningful, flexible, appropriate standards. You get great satisfaction from processes and experiences, and you are not exclusively fixated on outcomes. You don't have to be outstanding at everything, and you don't always have to try your best. You don't fear mistakes, but you see them as golden opportunities to learn and to endorse your humanity. Paradoxically, you are likely to be much more productive than your perfectionistic associates because you do not become compulsively preoccupied with detail and correctness. Your life is like a flowing river or a geyser compared with your rigid, perfectionistic friends who appear more like icy glaciers. 5. Entitlement. Attitudes 21 through 25 measure your sense of entitlement. A negative score indicates that you feel entitled to things. Success, love, happiness, etc. You expect and demand that your wants be met by other people and by the universe at large because of your inherent goodness or hard work. When this does not happen, as is often the case, you are locked into one of two reactions. Either you feel depressed and inadequate, or you become irate. Thus, you consume enormous amounts of energy being frustrated, sad, and mad. Much of the time, you see life as a sour, rotten experience. You complain loudly and often, but you do little to solve problems. After all, you're entitled to have them solved, so why should you have to put out any effort? As a result of your bitter, demanding attitudes, you invariably get far less of what you want from life. A positive score suggests you don't feel automatically entitled to things, so you negotiate for what you want and often get it. Because of your awareness that other people are unique and different, you realize there is no inherent reason why things should always go your way. You experience a negative outcome as a disappointment, but not a tragedy, because you are a percentage player, and you don't expect perfect reciprocity or justice at all times. You are patient and persistent, and you have a high frustration tolerance. As a result, you often end up ahead of the pack. 6. Omnipotence. Attitudes 26 through 30 measure your tendency to see yourself as the center of your personal universe and to hold yourself responsible for much of what goes on around you. A negative score indicates you often make the personalization error discussed in chapters 3 and 6. You blame yourself inappropriately for the negative actions and attitudes of others who are not really under your control. Consequently, you are plagued by guilt and self-condemnation. Paradoxically, the attitude that you should be omnipotent and all-powerful cripples you and leaves you anxious and ineffectual. A positive score, in contrast, indicates you know the joy that comes from accepting that you are not the center of the universe. Since you are not in control of other adults, you are not ultimately responsible for them, but only for yourself. This attitude does not isolate you from others. Quite the opposite is true. You relate to people effectively as a friendly collaborator, and you are not threatened when they disagree with your ideas or fail to follow your advice. Because your attitude gives people a sense of freedom and dignity, you paradoxically become a human magnet. Others often want to be close to you because you have relinquished any attempt to control them. People frequently listen to and respect your ideas because you do not polarize them with an angry insistence that they must agree with you. As you give up your drive for power, people repay you by making you a person of influence. Your relationships with your children and friends and associates are characterized by mutuality instead of dependency. Because you don't try to dominate people, they admire, love, and respect you. 7. Autonomy. Items 31 through 35 measure your autonomy. This refers to your ability to find happiness within yourself. A positive score indicates that all your moods are ultimately the children of your thoughts and attitudes. You assume responsibility for your feelings because you recognize they are ultimately created by you. This sounds as if you might be lonely and isolated because you realize that all meaning and feelings are created only in your head. Paradoxically, however, this vision of autonomy frees you from the petty confines of your mind and delivers the world to you with a full measure of all the satisfaction, mystery, and excitement that it can offer. A negative score suggests you are still trapped in the belief that your potential for joy and self-esteem comes from the outside. This puts you at a great disadvantage because everything outside is ultimately beyond your control. Your moods end up the victim of external factors. Do you want this? If not, you can eventually free yourself from this attitude as surely as a snake sheds its skin, but you will have to work at it with the various methods outlined in this book. When it's finally your turn to experience the transformation to autonomy and personal responsibility, you will be amazed, or awestruck, or pleased, or delightfully overwhelmed. It's well worth a major personal commitment. In the following chapters, a number of these attitudes and value systems will be examined in detail. As you study each one, ask yourself, 1. Is it to my advantage to maintain this particular belief? 2. Is this belief really true and valid? 3. What specific steps can I take that will allow me to rid myself of attitudes that are self-defeating and unrealistic, and substitute others that are more objective and more self-enhancing? Chapter 11. The Approval Addiction. Let's consider your belief that it would be terrible if someone disapproved of you. Why does disapproval pose such a threat? Perhaps your reasoning goes like this. If one person disapproves of me, it means that everyone would disapprove of me. It would mean there was something wrong with me. If these thoughts apply to you, your moods will shoot up every time you are being stroked. You reason, I got some positive feedback so I can feel good about myself. Why is this illogical? Because you are overlooking the fact that it is only your thoughts and beliefs which have the power to elevate your spirits. Another person's approval has no ability to affect your mood unless you believe what he or she says is valid. But if you believe the compliment is earned, it is your belief which makes you feel good. You must validate external approval before you experience mood elevation. This validation represents your personal self-approval. Suppose you are visiting the psychiatric ward of a hospital. A confused, hallucinating patient approaches you and says, "You are wonderful. I had a vision from God. He told me the 13th person to walk through the door would be the special messenger. You are the 13th, so I know you are God's chosen one, the Prince of Peace, the Holy of Holies. Let me kiss your shoe." Would this extreme approval elevate your mood? You'd probably feel nervous and uncomfortable. That's because you don't believe what the patient is saying is valid. You discredit the comments. It is only your beliefs about yourself that can affect the way you feel. Others can say or think whatever they want about you, good or bad, but only your thoughts will influence your emotions. The price you pay for your addiction to praise will be an extreme vulnerability to the opinions of others. Like any addict, you will find you must continue to feed your habit with approval in order to avoid withdrawal pangs. The moment someone who is important to you expresses disapproval, you will crash painfully, just like the junkie who can no longer get his stuff. Others will be able to use this vulnerability to manipulate you. You will have to give in to their demands more often than you want to because you fear they might reject or look down on you. You set yourself up for emotional blackmail. You may come to see that your addiction to approval is not to your advantage, but still believe that other people really do have the right to judge not only the merit of what you do and say, but also your worth as a human being. Imagine that you made a second visit to the psychiatric hospital ward. This time a different hallucinating patient approaches you and says, "You're wearing a red shirt. This shows you are the devil. You are evil." Would you feel bad because of this criticism and disapproval? Of course not. Why would these disapproving words not upset you? It's simple, because you don't believe the statements are true. You must buy into the other person's criticism and believe that you are in fact no good in order to feel bad about yourself. Did it ever occur to you that if someone disapproves of you, it might be his or her problem? Disapproval often reflects other people's irrational beliefs. To take an extreme example, Hitler's hateful doctrine that Jews were inferior did not reflect anything about the inner worth of the people he intended to destroy. There will, of course, be many occasions when disapproval will result from an actual error on your part. Does it follow that you are a worthless, no-good person? Obviously not. The other person's negative reaction can only be directed toward a specific thing you did, not at your worth. A human being cannot do wrong things all the time. Let's look at the other side of the coin. Many well-known criminals have had bands of fervent admirers regardless of how repulsive and abhorrent their crimes. Consider Charles Manson. He promoted sadism and murder, yet was regarded as a messiah by his numerous followers who seemed to do whatever he suggested. I want to make it abundantly clear that I am not advocating atrocious behavior, nor am I an admirer of Charles Manson. But ask yourself these questions. If Charles Manson did not end up totally rejected for what he did or said, what have you ever done that was so terrible that you will be rejected by everyone? And do you still believe in the equation? Approval equals worth? After all, Charles Manson enjoyed the intense adulation of his family. Did the approval he received make him an especially worthy person? This is obvious nonsense. It's a fact that approval feels good. There's nothing wrong with that. It's natural and healthy. It is also a fact that disapproval and rejection usually taste bitter and unpleasant. This is human and understandable. But you are swimming in deep, turbulent waters if you continue to believe that approval and disapproval are the proper and ultimate yardsticks with which to measure your worth. Did you ever criticize someone? Did you ever disagree with a friend's opinion? Did you ever scold a child because of his or her behavior? Did you ever snap at a loved one when you were feeling irritable? Did you ever choose not to associate with someone whose behavior was distasteful to you? Then ask yourself, when you disagreed or criticized or disapproved, were you making the ultimate moral judgment that the other person was a totally worthless, no-good human being? Do you have the power to make such sweeping judgments about other people? Or were you simply expressing the fact that you held a different point of view and were upset with what the other person did or said? For example, in the heat of anger, you may have blurted out to your spouse, "You're no damn good." But when the flame cools down a day or two later, didn't you admit to yourself that you were exaggerating the extent of his or her badness? Sure, your loved one may have many faults, but isn't it absurd to think your outburst of disapproval or criticism makes him or her totally and forever worthless? If you admit your disapproval does not contain enough moral atomic power to devastate the meaning and value of another person's life, why give their disapproval the power to wipe out your sense of self-worth? What makes them so special? When you tremble in terror because someone dislikes you, you magnify the wisdom and knowledge that person possesses, and you have simultaneously sold yourself short as being unable to make sound judgments about yourself. Of course, Someone might point out a flaw in your behavior or an error in your thinking. I hope they will, because you can learn this way. After all, we're all imperfect, and others have the right to tell us about it from time to time. But are you obliged to make yourself miserable and hate yourself every time someone flies off the handle or puts you down? The origin of the problem. Where did you get this approval addiction in the first place? We can only speculate that the answer may lie in your interactions with people who were important to you when you were a child. You may have had a parent who was unduly critical when you misbehaved, or who was irritable even at times when you weren't doing anything particularly wrong. Your mother may have snapped, "You're bad for doing that," or your father may have blurted out, "You're always goofing up. You'll never learn." As a small child, you probably saw your parents as gods. They taught you how to speak and tie your shoes, and most of what they told you was valid. If Daddy said, "You will be killed if you walk out into traffic," this was literally true. Like most children, you might have assumed that nearly everything your parents said was true. So when you heard, "You're no good and you'll never learn," you literally believed it, and this hurt badly. You were too young to be able to reason Daddy is exaggerating and overgeneralizing. And you didn't have the emotional maturity to see that Daddy was irritable and tired that day, or perhaps had been drinking and wanted to be left alone. You couldn't determine whether his outburst was his problem or yours. And if you were old enough to suggest he was being unreasonable, your attempts to put things into a sane perspective may have been rapidly deprogrammed and discouraged with a swift smack on the behind. No wonder you developed the bad habit of automatically looking down on yourself every time someone disapproved of you. It wasn't your fault that you picked up this tendency as a child, and you can't be blamed for growing up with this blind spot. But it is your responsibility as an adult to think the issue through realistically, and to take specific steps to outgrow this particular vulnerability. Just how does this fear of disapproval predispose you to anxiety and depression? John is an unmarried, soft-spoken 52-year-old architect who lives in fear of criticism. He was referred for treatment because of a severe recurring depression, which has not diminished in spite of several years of therapy. One day, when he was feeling particularly good about himself, he approached his boss enthusiastically with some new ideas about an important project. The boss snapped. "Later, John, can't you see I'm busy?" John's self-esteem collapsed instantly. He dragged himself back to his office, drowning in despair and self-hatred, telling himself he was no good. "How could I have been so thoughtless?" he asked himself. As John shared this episode with me, I asked him the simple and obvious questions. Who was the one who was acting goofy, you or your boss? Were you actually behaving in an inappropriate manner, or was your boss acting irritable and unpleasant? After a moment's reflection, he was able to identify the true culprit. The possibility that the boss was acting obnoxiously had not occurred to him because of his automatic habit of blaming himself. He felt relief when he realized, suddenly, he had absolutely nothing to be ashamed of and how he had acted. His boss, who was aloof, was probably under pressure himself and off the mark that day. John then raised the question, "Why am I always struggling so hard for approval? Why do I fall apart like this?" He then remembered an event that occurred when he was 12. His only sibling, a younger brother, had tragically died after a long bout with leukemia. After the funeral, he overheard his mother and grandmother talking in the bedroom. His mother was weeping bitterly and said, "Now I've got nothing to live for." His grandmother responded, "Shush, Johnny is just down the hall. He might hear you." As John shared this with me, he began to weep. He had heard these comments, and they meant to him, "This proves I'm not worth much. My brother was the important one. My mother doesn't really love me." He never let on that he had been listening, and through the years he tried to push the memory out of his mind by telling himself, "It really isn't important whether or not she loves me anyway." But he struggled intensely to please his mother with his achievements and his career in a desperate bid to win her approval. In his heart, he didn't believe he had any true worth and perceived himself as inferior and unlovable. He tried to compensate for his missing self-esteem by earning other people's admiration and approval. His life was like a constant effort to inflate a balloon with a hole in it. After recalling this incident, John was able to see the irrationality of his reaction to the comments he had overheard in the hall. His mother's bitterness and the emptiness she felt were a natural part of the grieving process that any parent goes through when a child dies. Her comments had nothing to do with John, but only with her temporary depression and despair. Putting this memory into a new perspective helped John see how illogical and self-defeating it was to link his worth to the opinions of others. Perhaps you too are beginning to see that your belief in the importance of external approval is highly unrealistic. Ultimately, you, and only you, can make yourself consistently happy. No one else can. Now, let's review some simple steps that you can take to put these principles into practice so you can transform your desire for self-esteem and self-respect into an emotional reality. The Path to Independence and Self-Respect. Cost-Benefit Analysis. The first step in overcoming your belief in any of the self-defeating assumptions from the DAS test is to perform a cost-benefit analysis. Ask yourself, what are the advantages and disadvantages of telling myself that disapproval makes me less worthwhile? After listing all the ways this attitude hurts you and helps you, you will be in a position to make an enlightened decision to develop a healthier value system. For example, a 33-year-old married woman named Susan found she was overly involved with church and community activities because she was a responsible and capable worker and was frequently selected for various committees. She felt enormously pleased every time she was chosen for a new job, and she feared saying no to any requests because that would mean risking someone's disapproval. Because she was terrified about letting people down, she became more and more addicted to the cycle of giving up her own interests and desires in order to please others. The DAS test and the vertical arrow technique, described in the previous chapter, revealed one of her silent assumptions to be, "I must always do what people expect me to do." She seemed reluctant to give up this belief, so she performed a cost-benefit analysis found in Figure 11.1 on the enhancement. Because the disadvantages of her approval addiction greatly outweighed the advantages, she became much more open to changing her personal philosophy. Try this simple technique with regard to one of your self-defeating assumptions about disapproval. It can be an important first step to personal growth. Rewrite the assumption. If, based on your cost-benefit analysis, you see that your fear of disapproval hurts you more than it helps, the second step is to rewrite your silent assumption so that it becomes more realistic and more self-enhancing. You can do this with any of the 35 attitudes on the DAS test that represent areas of psychological vulnerability for you. In the above example, Susan decided to revise her belief as follows. It can be enjoyable to have someone approve of me, but I don't need approval in order to be a worthwhile person or to respect myself. Disapproval can be uncomfortable, but it doesn't mean I'm less of a person. The Self-Respect Blueprint. As a third step, it might help you to write a brief essay entitled, Why It Is Irrational and Unnecessary to Live in Fear of Disapproval or Criticism. This can be your personal blueprint for achieving greater self-reliance and autonomy. Prepare a list of all the reasons why disapproval is unpleasant, but not fatal. A few have already been mentioned in this chapter, and you might review them before you begin to write. In your essay, include only what seems convincing and helpful to you. Make sure you believe each argument you write down so your new sense of independence will be realistic. Don't rationalize. For example, the statement, "If someone disapproves of me, I don't need to get upset because they're really not the kind of person I'd care to have as a friend," won't work because it's a distortion. You are trying to preserve your self-esteem by writing the other person off as no good. Stick with what you know to be the truth. As new ideas come to you, add them to your list. Read it over every morning for several weeks. This might be a first step in helping you trim other people's negative opinions and comments about you down to life size. Here are a few ideas that have worked well for a lot of people. You might use some of them in your own essay. 1. Remember that when someone reacts negatively to you, it may be his or her irrational thinking that is at the heart of the disapproval. 2. If the criticism is valid, this need not destroy you. You can pinpoint your error and take steps to correct it. You can learn from your mistakes, and you don't have to be ashamed of them. If you are human, then you should and must make mistakes at times. 3. If you have goofed up, it does not follow that you are a born loser. It is impossible to be wrong all the time or even most of the time. Think about the thousands of things you have done right in your life. Furthermore, you can change and grow. 4. Other people cannot judge your worth as a human being, only the validity or merit of specific things you do or say. 5. Everyone will judge you differently no matter how well you do or how badly you might behave. Disapproval cannot spread like wildfire, and one rejection cannot lead to a never-ending series of rejections. So even if worse comes to worse and you do get rejected by someone, you can't end up totally alone. 6. Disapproval and criticism are usually uncomfortable, but the discomfort will pass. Stop moping. Get involved in an activity you've enjoyed in the past, even though you feel certain it's absolutely pointless to start. 7. Criticism and disapproval can upset you only to the extent that you buy into the accusations being brought against you. 8. Disapproval is rarely permanent. It doesn't follow that your relationship with the person who disapproves of you will necessarily end just because you are being criticized. Arguments are part of living, and in the majority of cases, you can come to a common understanding later on. 9. If you are criticizing someone else, it doesn't make that person totally bad. Why give another individual the power and right to judge you? We're all just human beings, not Supreme Court justices. Don't magnify other people until they are larger than life. Can you come up with some additional ideas? Think about this topic over the next few days. Jot your ideas down on a piece of paper. Develop your own philosophy about disapproval. You'll be surprised to find how much this can help you change your perspective and enhance your sense of independence. Verbal techniques. In addition to learning to think differently about disapproval, it can be a lot of help to learn to behave differently toward individuals who express disapproval. As a first step, review the assertive methods, such as the disarming technique presented in Chapter 6. Now we will discuss some additional approaches to help you build your skills in coping with disapproval. First of all, if you fear someone's disapproval, have you ever thought of asking the person if he or she, in fact, does look down on you? You might be pleasantly surprised to learn that the disapproval existed only in your head. Although it requires some courage, the payoff can be tremendous. Remember Art, the psychiatrist described in Chapter 6 who was receiving training at the University of Pennsylvania? Art had no suspicion that a particular patient of his might be suicidal. The patient had no history or symptoms of depression, but felt hopelessly trapped in an intolerable marriage. Art received a call one morning that his patient had been found dead with a bullet hole through his head. Although the suspicion of homicide was raised, the probable cause of death was suicide. Art had never lost a patient in this way. His reaction included sadness because of his fondness for this particular patient, and anxiety for fear that his supervisor and peers would disapprove of him and look down on him for his mistake and lack of foresight. After discussing the death with his supervisor, he asked, frankly, "Do you feel I have let you down?" His supervisor's response conveyed a sense of warmth and empathy, not rejection. Art was relieved when his supervisor told him that he too had experienced a similar disappointment in the past. He emphasized that this was an opportunity for Art to learn to cope with one of the professional hazards of being a psychiatrist. By discussing the case and refusing to give in to his fear of disapproval, Art learned that he had made an error. He had overlooked the fact that a feeling of hopelessness can lead to suicide in individuals who are not clinically depressed. But he also learned that others did not demand perfection of him, and that he wasn't expected to guarantee a successful outcome for any patient. Suppose it had not turned out so well, and his supervisor or peers had condemned him for being thoughtless or incompetent. What then? The worst possible outcome would have been rejection. Let's talk about some strategies for coping with the worst conceivable eventuality. Rejection is never your fault. Aside from bodily injury or a destruction of your assets, the greatest pain a person can try to inflict on you is through rejection. This threat is the source of your fear when you are being put down. There are several types of rejection. The most common and obvious is called adolescent rejection, although it is not limited to the adolescent age group. Suppose you have a romantic interest in someone you are dating or have met, and it turns out you're not his or her cup of tea. Perhaps it's your looks, race, religion, or personality style that are the problem. Or maybe you're too tall, short, fat, thin, old, young, smart, dull, aggressive, passive, etc. Since you don't fit that person's mental image of an ideal mate closely enough, He or she rebuffs your advances and gives you the cold shoulder. Is this your fault? Obviously not. The individual is simply turning you down because of subjective preferences and tastes. One person may like apple pie better than cherry pie. Does this mean that cherry pie is inherently undesirable? Romantic interests are almost infinitely variable. If you were one of those toothpaste commercial types who is blessed with what our culture defines as good looks and an appealing personality, it will be much easier for you to attract potential dates and mates. But you will learn this mutual attraction is a far cry from developing a loving, permanent relationship, and even the beautiful and handsome types will have to cope with rejection sometimes. No one can turn on each and every person they meet. If you are only average or below average in appearance and personality, you will have to work harder initially to attract people, and you may have to cope with more frequent turndowns. You will have to develop your social skills and master some powerful secrets of making people feel attracted to you. These are, 1, don't sell yourself short by looking down on yourself. Refuse to persecute yourself. Boost your self-esteem to the hilt with the methods outlined in Chapter 4. If you love yourself, people will respond to the sense of joy you radiate and want to be close to you. 2, express genuine compliments to people. Instead of waiting around nervously to find out if they will like you or reject you, like them first and let them know about it. 3. Show an interest in other people by learning about what turns them on. Get them to talk about what excites them most, and respond to their comments in an upbeat manner. If you persevere along these lines, you will eventually discover there are people who find you attractive, and you in turn will discover you have a great capacity for happiness. Adolescent rejection is an uncomfortable nuisance, but it's not the end of the world, and it's not your fault. Aha, you retort. But how about the situation where a lot of people reject you because you turn them off with your abrasive mannerisms? Suppose you're conceited and self-centered. Certainly that's your fault, isn't it? This is a second type of rejection, which I call angry rejection. Again, I think you will see that it's not your fault if you are angrily rejected because of a personal fault. In the first place, other people aren't obliged to reject you just because they find things about you they don't like. They have other options. They can be assertive and point out what they don't like about your behavior, or they can learn not to let it bother them so much. Of course, they have the right to avoid and reject you if they want, and they are free to choose any friends they prefer, but this doesn't mean that you are an inherently bad human being, and it is definitely not the case that everyone will react to you in the same negative way. You will experience a spontaneous chemistry with some people, whereas you will tend to clash with others. This is no one's fault. It's just a fact of life. If you have a personality quirk that alienates more people than you would like, such as being excessively critical or losing your temper frequently, it would definitely be to your advantage to modify your style. But it's ridiculous to blame yourself if someone rejects you based on this imperfection. We're all imperfect, and your tendency to fault yourself or to buy into the hostility that someone else directs at you is self-defeating and pointless. The third type of rejection is manipulative rejection. In this case, the other person uses the threat of withdrawal or rejection to manipulate you in some way. Unhappy spouses and even frustrated psychotherapists sometimes resort to this ploy to coerce you into changing. The formula goes like this. Either you do such and such, or we're all through. This is a highly irrational and usually self-defeating way of trying to influence people. Such manipulative rejection is simply a culturally taught coping pattern, and it is usually ineffective. It rarely leads to an enhanced relationship because it generates tension and resentment. What it really indicates is a low frustration tolerance and poor interpersonal skills on the part of the individual making the threat. It certainly isn't your fault that they do this, and it usually isn't to your advantage to let yourself be manipulated this way. So much for the theoretical aspects. Now, what can you say and do when you are actually getting rejected? One effective way to learn is to use role-playing. To make the dialogue more entertaining and challenging, I will play the role of the rejector and confront you with the worst things about you I can think of. Since I'm acting caustic and insulting, begin by asking if I am in fact rejecting you because of the way I've been treating you lately. You, Dr. Burns, I notice you've been acting somewhat cool and distant. You seem to be avoiding me. When I try to talk to you, you either ignore me or snap at me. I wonder if you are upset with me or if you've had thoughts of rejecting me. Comment. You don't accuse me initially of rejecting you. That would put me on the defensive. Furthermore, I might not be rejecting you. I might be upset about the fact that nobody's buying my book, so I'm just generally irritable. Just for practice, let's assume the worst, that I am trying to dump you. David, I'm glad we got it out in the open. I have, in fact, decided to reject you. You,
why?
Apparently, I've been turning you off a lot. You're a no-good piece of rot. I can see you're upset with me. Just what have I been doing wrong?
Comment. You avoid defending yourself. Since you know you are not a piece of rot, there's no point in insisting to me that you're not. It will just fire me up more, and our dialogue will quickly deteriorate into a shouting match. This empathy method was presented in detail in Chapter 6.
David, everything about you stinks.
You,
can you be specific? Did I forget to use deodorant? Are you upset by the way I talk? Something I've said lately? My clothes? Or what?
Comment.
Again, you resist getting sucked into an argument. By urging me to pinpoint what I dislike about you, you were forcing me to fire my best shot and say something meaningful, or end up looking like an ass.
David, well, you hurt my feelings when you put me down the other day. You don't give a damn about me. I'm just a thing to you, not a human being.
Comment. This is a common criticism. It tips you off that the rejector basically cares for you but feels deprived and fears losing you. The rejector decides to lash out at you to protect his shaky self-esteem. The rejector might also say you're too stupid, too fat, too selfish, etc. Whatever the nature of the criticism, your strategy is now twofold. A. Find some grain of truth in the criticism and let the rejector know you agree in part, see the disarming technique, Chapter 6. B. Apologize or offer to try to correct any actual error you actually did make. See Feedback and Negotiation, Chapter 6.
You. I'm really sorry I said something that rubbed you the wrong way. What was it?
David. You told me I was a no-good jerk, so I've had it with you. This is the end.
I can see that that was a thoughtless, hurtful comment I made. What other things have I said that hurt your feelings? Was that all? Or have I done this many times? Go ahead and say all the bad things you think about me.
You're unpredictable. You can be sweet as sugar, and then all of a sudden, you're cutting me to shreds with your sharp tongue. When you get mad, you turn into a foul-mouthed pig. I can't stand you, and I can't see how anyone else puts up with you. You're arrogant and cocky and don't give a damn about anyone but yourself. You're a selfish snot, and it's time you woke up and learned the hard way. I'm sorry I've got to be the one to put you down, but it's the only way you're going to learn. You have no real feelings for anyone but yourself, and we're through for good.
Well, I can see there are numerous problems in our relationship we've never looked at, and it sounds like I've really been missing the boat. I can see that I have been acting irritable and thoughtless. I can see how unpleasant I've been and how uncomfortable it's been for you. Tell me more about this side of me.
Comment. You then continue to extract negative comments from the rejector. Avoid being defensive and continue to find some grain of truth in what the rejector says. After you have elicited all the criticisms and agreed with whatever was true about them, you are ready to fire the sharpest arrow straight into the rejector's balloon. Point out that you have acknowledged your imperfections and that you are willing to try to correct your errors. Then ask the rejector why he is rejecting you. This maneuver will help you see why rejection is never your fault. You are responsible for your errors, and you will assume responsibility for trying to correct them. But if someone rejects you for your imperfections, that's their goofiness, not yours. Here's how this works.
You, I can see I've done and said a number of things you don't like. I'm certainly willing to try to correct these problems to the greatest extent possible. I can't promise miracles, but if we work at it together, I see no reason why things can't improve. Just by talking this way, our communications are already better. So why are you going to reject me?
David, because you infuriate me.
Well, sometimes differences come up between people, but I don't see that this has to destroy our relationship. Are you rejecting me because you feel infuriated, or what?
You're a no-good bum, and I refuse to talk to you again.
I'm sorry you feel that way. I'd much prefer to continue our friendship in spite of these hurt feelings. Do we need to break off entirely? Maybe this discussion was just what we needed to understand each other better. I don't really know why you've decided to reject me. Can you tell me why?
Oh, no, I'm not being tricked by you. You goofed up once too often, and that's it. No second chances. Goodbye.
Comment. Now whose goofy behavior is this? Yours or the one who is rejecting you? Whose fault is it that the rejection occurs? After all, you offer to try to correct your errors and to improve the relationship through frank communication and compromise. So how can you be blamed for the rejection? Obviously, you can't. Using the above approach may not prevent all actual rejections, but you will enhance the probability of a positive outcome sooner or later.
Recovering from disapproval or rejection.
You actually have been disapproved of or rejected in spite of your efforts to improve the relationship with the other person. How can you most quickly overcome the emotional upset you understandably feel? First, you must realize that life goes on, so this particular disappointment need not impair the quality of your happiness forever. Following the rejection or disapproval, it will be your thoughts which are doing the emotional damage. And if you fight these thoughts and stubbornly refuse to give in to distorted self-abuse, the upset will pass.
One method which might be quite helpful is one that has aided people who experience prolonged grief reactions following the loss of a loved one. If bereaved individuals schedule periods each day to allow themselves to be flooded by the painful memories and thoughts of the deceased loved one, this can accelerate and complete the grieving process. If you do this when you are alone, it will be most helpful. Sympathy from another person often backfires. Some studies have reported that it prolongs the painful period of mourning. You can use this grieving method to cope with rejection or disapproval. Schedule one or more periods of time each day, 5 to 10 minutes are probably enough, to think all the sad, angry, and despairing thoughts you want. If you feel sad, cry. If you feel mad, pound a pillow. Keep flooding yourself with painful memories and thoughts for the full time period you have set aside. Bitch, moan, and complain nonstop. When your scheduled sad period is over, stop it and carry on with life until your next scheduled cry session. In the meantime, if you have negative thoughts, write them down, pinpoint the distortions, and substitute rational responses as outlined in previous chapters. You may find this will help you gain partial control over your disappointment and hasten your return to full self-esteem more quickly than you anticipated. Turning on the inner light. The key to emotional enlightenment is the knowledge that only your thoughts can affect your moods. If you are an approval addict, you are in the bad habit of flicking your inner switch only when someone else shines their light on you first. And you mistakenly confuse their approval with your own self-approval because the two occur almost simultaneously. You mistakenly conclude that the other person has made you feel good. The fact that you do at times enjoy praise and compliments proves that you know how to approve of yourself. But if you are an approval addict, you have developed the self-defeating habit of endorsing yourself only when someone you respect approves of you first. Here's a simple way to break that habit. Obtain the wrist counter described in earlier chapters and wear it for at least 2 or 3 weeks. Every day, try to notice positive things about yourself, things you do well whether or not you get an external reward. Each time you do something you approve of, click the counter. For example, if you smile warmly at an associate one morning, click whether he scowls or smiles back. If you make that phone call you were putting off, click the counter. You can endorse yourself for big or trivial things. You can even click it if you remember positive things you did in the past. For example, you might recall the day you got your driver's license or your first job. Click the counter whether or not you have a positive emotional arousal. Initially, you may have to force yourself to notice good things about yourself, and it may seem mechanical. Persist anyway, because after several days, I think you will notice that the inner light is beginning to glow, dimly at first and then more brightly. Every night, look at the digits on the counter and record the total number of personal endorsements on your daily log. After 2 or 3 weeks, I suspect you will begin to learn the art of self-respect, and you will feel much better about yourself. This simple procedure can be a big first step toward achieving independence and self-approval. It sounds easy, and it is. It's surprisingly powerful, and the rewards will be well worth the small amount of time and effort involved. Chapter 12. The Love Addiction.
The silent assumption, which often goes hand in hand with the fear of disapproval, is, I cannot be a truly happy and fulfilled human being unless I am loved by a member of the opposite sex. True love is necessary for ultimate happiness. The demand or need for love before you can feel happy is called dependency. Dependency means that you are unable to assume responsibility for your emotional life. The disadvantages of being a love junkie. Is being loved an absolute necessity or a desirable option? Roberta is a 33-year-old single woman who moped around her apartment evenings and weekends because she told herself, it's a couple's world. Without a man, I am nothing. She came to my office attractively groomed, but her comments were bitter. She was brimming with resentment because she was sure that being loved was as crucial as the oxygen she breathed. However, she was so needy and greedy that this tended to drive people away. I suggested that she start by preparing a list of the advantages and disadvantages of believing that without a man or woman, I am nothing. The disadvantages on Roberta's list were clear-cut. 1. This belief makes me despondent, since I have no lover. 2. Furthermore, it takes away any incentive I might have to do things and go places. 3. It makes me feel lazy. 4. It brings on a sense of self-pity. 5. It robs me of self-pride and confidence and makes me envious of others and bitter. 6. Finally, it brings on self-destructive feelings and a terrible fear of being alone. Then she listed what she thought were the advantages of believing that being loved was an absolute necessity for happiness. 1. This belief will bring me a companion, love, and security. 2. It will give purpose to my life and a reason to live. 3. It will give me events to look forward to. These advantages reflected Roberta's belief that telling herself she couldn't live without a man would somehow bring a companion into her life. Were these advantages real or imaginary? Although Roberta had believed for many years that she couldn't exist without a man, this attitude still hadn't brought a desirable mate. She admitted that making men so totally important in her life was not the magic charm that would bring one to her doorstep. She acknowledged that clinging and dependent individuals often demand so much attention from other people and appear so needy that they have great difficulty not only initially attracting people of the opposite sex, but also maintaining an ongoing relationship. Roberta was able to grasp the idea that people who have found happiness within themselves are usually the most desirable to members of the opposite sex and become like magnets because they are at peace and generate a sense of joy. Ironically, it is usually the dependent woman, the manaholic, who ends up alone. This really isn't so surprising. If you take the position you need someone else for a sense of worth, you broadcast the following, take me, I have no inherent worth, I can't stand myself. No wonder there are so few buyers. Of course, your unstated demand does not endear people to you either. Since you're obliged to love me, you're rotten shit if you don't. You may cling to your dependency because of your erroneous notion that if you do not achieve independence, others will see you as a rejecting person and you will end up alone. If this is your fear, you are equating dependency with warmth. Nothing could be farther from the truth. If you are lonely and dependent, your anger and resentment stem from the fact that you feel deprived of the love you believe you are entitled to receive from others. This attitude drives you farther into isolation. If you are more independent, you are not obliged to be alone. You simply have the capacity to feel happy when you are alone. The more independent you are, the more secure you will be in your feelings. Furthermore, your moods will not go up and down at someone else's mercy. After all, the amount of love that someone can feel for you is often quite unpredictable. They may not appreciate everything about you, and they may not act in an affectionate way all the time. If you are willing to learn to love yourself, you will have a far more dependable and continuous source of self-esteem. The first step is to find out if you want independence. All of us have a much greater chance of achieving our goals if we understand what they are. It helped Roberta to realize that her dependency was condemning her to an empty existence. If you are still clinging to the notion that it is desirable to be dependent, list the advantages using the double-column technique. Spell out how you benefit if you let love determine your personal worth. Then, in order to assess the situation objectively, write down the counterarguments or rational responses in the right-hand column. You may learn that the advantages of your love addiction are partially or totally illusory. Figure 12.1, which you can find on the enhancement, shows how a woman with a